Welcome to the latest episode of Inspiring Futures. My guest today is Ian Murray. Ian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Ed. Thanks for having me.
Whereabouts are you broadcasting from?
I'm broadcasting from halfway up a snow-capped hill in Scotland, basically. But it's not as quite as remote as I'm making that sound, because it's still only about half an hour away from the two biggest cities in Scotland, Glasgow on one side and Edinburgh on the other. So back home after many years in London and a little bit of time in New York as well.
Great. Has the Scottish winter started yet, or is it yet to appear?
Well, you know, I think, Ed, before we were chatting earlier, and you mentioned you know Scotland a little bit, so winter's the default setting, and it's just when spring and summer make an occasional appearance. So it's beautiful sunny day today, but you know it's four seasons in one day usually.
Yeah, that's great. So, Ian, why don't you start and tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit of a history of how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, I mean, so where I am today is a consultancy called Burst Your Bubble that I set up. It's very new, actually. I only set it up last summer with my business partner, Andrew Tenzer. Basically, that came out of the work that I've been doing probably over the previous 10 years, which is a whole lot of behavioral science and social science frameworks being applied to what we call the culture of marketing. And so what we mean by that is actually kind of looking at how marketers view the world, their worldviews, and seeing if that really matches up with what is actually out there, you know, in terms of what people are actually doing and feeling. So we, over the last 6 or 7 years, we wrote two or three white papers that certainly, I'm not so sure how much traction they got over in the US, but certainly the UK, we caused a bit of a storm with two or three white papers that we wrote here, one called The Empathy Delusion, another one called The Aspiration Window, which in a nutshell produced a whole lot of data that showed that effectively the marketing industry, its values, its worldviews are actually quite different from the mainstream, but also marketers are very bad at figuring out what the mainstream values are and very good at projecting their own values onto the mainstream. Now, in terms of how I got there, is basically I've been doing brand communications, advertising research for the best part of 30 years. Something that culminated before I started my own business about 10 years ago. I was managing director of Holland Partners in London. And that's really the kind of world I've been immersed in for some time, is, you know, figuring out how marketing and advertising works, doing research to explain effectiveness in media, et cetera, to many of the world's biggest brands. And I suppose the opportunity when I started my own business was to take a lot of stuff that had been kind of nagging and bugging me for some time as I kind of climbed the ladder in the industry, being what would be described as socially mobile myself and experiencing a lot of these things firsthand about these disconnects that I thought I saw. And I suppose that's really where it came from, is just being very, very aware that a lot of the things and the stories that we tell ourselves in the industry about how things work from a marketing point of view, but also more broadly as we become more and more interested as an industry in contributing to culture and social and economic transformation, just become very, very aware, given the background that I had personally, that a lot of the stuff just didn't fit with the kind of world I knew before I became a kind of socially mobile researcher and media marketing type, basically.
So how long were you at Holland Partners for?
In two stints, I was probably there two stints, probably about 2 or 3 years each time, probably about 6 years in total. I was there in a more junior capacity. Then I went away for 7 years to a competitor. As often these things happen, and I got poached back to do the managing partner job in London. It was an agency called HPI, which doesn't exist anymore. It was acquired several years ago by what is now Savanta, which is a reasonably big research company that's hoovered up quite a few others. So yeah, so that was the those were the last proper jobs I had before I went out on my own and had my own consultancy, which I've been doing more or less in various guises for over a decade now.
Cool. So Hall & Partners, a lot of, well, I would assume quite a few of my listeners will have heard of them. Some might not have, but it's an interesting company. You know, it's founded by an ex-agency account planner, right? Who had some sort of degree of dissatisfaction with the way that clients would test their advertising.
I mean, I'm old enough to I was there the first time when Mike was still very active in the business, and I think a lot of, to be candid, the approach that I take to how I think about things in the industry, I think very much the first time I was at Hall & Partners, they were very much formative years for me, because although the remit at that time was much more narrowly on how does advertising work, that's what Mike's framework was all about, and that's what he was very successful in doing. That, if you like, what would you say, heterodox approach, and, you know, challenging, you know, the received wisdom that basically drove Mike and therefore the initial success of that company. I think that's very much still the principles that, you know, I try and live by now, you know, though I suppose I'm working on a broader remit now about, you know, what it's about. So yeah, I mean, the very, very fundamental principles that Mike built the business on, to me, are still the ones that I remind people of all the time. You know, it's like advertising works in different ways. You have to measure them all, you know. So, and I think I think one of the things that happens a lot is that we're always looking for, you know, straightforward ways to explain very complicated things, and that can lead us into, frankly, quite reductionist models. And I think those basic principles of, you know, it's complicated, it works in many different ways, they don't all have to even agree. It's a very, very, very diverse thing we're doing with a lot of different potential outcomes. I think that's basically, I think probably the most formative thing in my career was just that, you know, knowledge that if you did try and kind of, as I say, apply some heterodox thinking, there can be a lot of kind of value in doing that.
Yeah, definitely. So we got a lot of stuff going on right now. It's sort of like there's so many forces of change in the industry. You know, sort of on one hand, you've got sort of, you know, the sort of world we grew up in, which was where television advertising dominated. It's sort of diminishing rapidly. And, you know, we've got 70-80% of the spend now being focused on digital. And so I wonder how that changes things, because I think it was like, you could make an argument very clearly, because everyone sort of saw advertising and it sort of appeared in places and it was talked about and it had sort of wide conversational value. And now advertising sort of buried, you know, it's sort of underground in a way. And I wonder what you think about that, just that difference, the one which we were working in a medium that was very culturally visible. And we're now, it's almost insidious, you know, it's almost sort of wormed its way into people's lives in a very different way through the digital channels. I wonder what you thought about that shift.
Well, it's interesting. There's a piece of work that we launched just in January with Rich Kirk at Essence MediaCom in London. And it's a follow-up to a study that I did a few years ago with Thinkbox in the UK, which is all about the theories from basically evolutionary psychology around signalling, honest signalling or costly signalling, something that Rory Sutherland talks about quite a lot in his book Alchemy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's another part of my background. So after the Hall & Partners days, setting up my own business, what was my angle going to be? And I'm one of these crazies who setting up my own business wasn't enough for me. I went back as a mature student and took a degree in behavioural science at the time as well. So a master's in behavioural science. And again, trying to think about that as a way of applying a broader lens onto, you know, how this thing called advertising and marketing works. And there's some really, really interesting stuff in there when you get into the broad stuff. So evolution psychology, that idea of the famous way of thinking about it is that apparently when Darwin, after he'd figured it all out, looked at the peacock's tail, and apparently the quote is that the peacock's tail made him sick, right? You know, because he's thinking, hang on, I've got all this figured out. This tail just doesn't fit in there, this cumbersome appendage. How can that be a good idea? How does it, you know, escape prey, etc., blah, blah, blah. And of course, figure it all out, and it turns out that the tail is what is now known as a costly signal. It's there for the peahen. And the idea is that almost the handicap of the tail is the point. It's an expensive, extravagant thing. It signals to the peahen, this guy must be a good bet if he can afford that, you know, and all the resources that go into that. So, and it turns out human beings are very attuned to these costly signals because guess what? We are animals as well. We're part of that evolutionary process. So, interestingly, think about this from a media perspective, and that thing that you just said there, it's absolutely true that spend is moving away from so-called traditional or legacy media, you know, TV in particular, towards digital channels. Well, here's the interesting thing, is that does that mean that because the spend is going in the media industry and the advertising industry towards other channels, does that mean that actually the cultural significance of the so-called legacy channels are actually dwindling proportionately to where the spend is going? So we've done two really big pieces of research. As I say, the most recent one came out just in January, an update of the Thinkbox one that's taken all the media channels, so the traditional ones, TV, radio, out of home, cinema, etc., and set it against a lot of the kind of incredibly fragmented digital and other channels that are going, and applied these principles of signaling to them. And the idea being that people out there in the real world intuitively understand the value of the signal that's coming from different media based primarily on what it costs, and the other thing being how many other people they think will see it, and therefore how widely known it will be. And over about, what we've done now, 8 or 9,000 nationally representative interviews using experimental design, a fictional brand. There can be nothing else coming to the experiment other than the channel that the media are in. And we find that TV still produces the strongest signals in terms of what we call fitness, which is things like signaling a brand's quality, reliability, financial strength and success. And then also what we then call social signaling, which is kind of riffing off the, I always think the main source for me is Kevin Simler's idea of common knowledge, you know, the idea that it's not what any individual knows about the brand, it's what you know that other people know about it. So that idea, fame in another way, you know, how famous is this? How much would it be in terms of social norms regarded as a good choice if other people knew you were making it? And it turns out when we map all these things, despite the fact that all the money is now going towards digital, the strongest brand, the strongest channels for signaling these two incredibly important things about your brand are still all the so-called legacy media. So this is one of the areas where I'm talking about is that we end up with this kind of, I think what this shows is one of these examples of a divergence between where the industry's going and actually this incredibly powerful cultural phenomenon that still exists, whether it's TV or cinema or whatever, that's still incredibly useful for doing the stuff that marketers say is really important to them. For example, being part of culture. You know, we did a piece of work last summer where we were asked to look at the transcripts of lots of interviews that have been done with CMOs at the Cannes Festival. And the overarching theme from all of them was this idea that they wanted their brands to take their place in culture. And then we have, how are they going to go about that? Well, they're going to push all their money into digital, a hyper-individualized, fragmented kind of landscape. And here's this stuff that they call legacy that's still there doing this incredible cultural job. So I think there's loads of economic reasons for it. There's loads of other reasons, but why there's a shift in spend. But it's not the case that because we've moved spend into digital, TV, radio, cinema don't have cultural power. And I think there's actually a chance that we should be trying to look at the balance again there and see that the things that we're trying to do, they may be still the best place to do it. I mean, we're talking the day after the Super Bowl here, Ed. And if there's one thing that I think the Super Bowl, $7 million, for a Super Bowl ad, that's probably the best example of costly signaling at work that I can think of. You know, it's mass, it's expensive, and people know it is, and they know other people will have seen it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that it's the exception to the rule, like, that you can find that big audience that you can make a cultural statement. And the problem is that, how do you find these audiences that can scale up and impact culture? So I guess my question is all digital the same, or is some digital more culturally relevant than others?
Well, there's obviously a spread like there is with anything, but what's interesting is what is digital and all those kinds of questions as well, but let's just go broadly. I mean, certainly the stuff that, if we're going to talk about the signaling stuff, then certainly, the YouTubes of this world do better on signaling, because maybe they're the ones that most approximate what might be, you might see television, it's called television, and what is television now, and all that kind of blurring. But certainly one of the things that we have equipped, that we've put out in some of the pieces on the Essence MediaCom stuff, is this idea that one of the problems is that social media, in inverted commas, isn't very social at all, because it doesn't have the kind of signals, because it's actually the personalization at scale is actually part of the problem. It's very difficult, from what we look at, to imagine how you build culture through these incredibly kind of fragmented, personalized, you've no idea if anybody else is seeing the same thing you are, etc., etc. So broadly speaking, when we, and we've put a couple of pieces out there and some very simple maps on there, broadly speaking, it does break down. It seems very kind of simplistic that all legacy media do better on this stuff than any of the new digital stuff. And that's not to say that if you've got the right message to a particular person, that could still be the right message. But we're talking about this big idea about culture, building it up from very, very small atomized pieces doesn't seem like, frankly, even a very efficient way to do it when you've got things that can still generate mass awareness. One other thing is that, so young people, for example, we hear this is that obviously their media consumption habits are changing, and they are very different now from, older generations. That's a fact. We're not denying that. But here's the interesting thing about culture. Young people have the same pattern of response on signaling that older generations do. So it's true they're watching less TV, but it doesn't have any less a cultural impact for them. The knowledge that a brand is on these channels still has an impact. So it's this idea about, do you have to actually, this is a bit of a mind-melting idea, do you actually have to target someone, and do they have to have attended to the ad on that channel, or is it sufficient that in terms of this idea, Simler's idea of common knowledge, the awareness that this is the kind of thing that is happening, even if you're not consuming it, still gives the brand the power.
Yeah, it seems like you should be, to promote this study, you should be using the as seen on TV sticker.
We have used it in the past in the previous study. That's exactly what did the big red RT. And one of the things Rich and I joked about doing is that making an equivalent one for as seen on TikTok, for example, and actually saying, look, here's the thing that we hear that young people are doing the most of now, and it's all in opposition to TV. But if you do as seen on TV and as seen on TikTok, 16 to 24s, as seen on TV responses, are still much stronger than their as seen on TikTok responses in terms of these fitness and social signals, as we call them. So the consumption patterns might be different, but the cultural resonance of TV is still a big thing, even for young people.
It's, I guess it goes back to the question of what is culture as well, and that, and the sort of the there's this culture versus cultures, and sort of I guess that goes to that point of people going into their discrete groups. You see so much of that, the whole fandom phenomenon, and back to narrowcasting. Do you think about that? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things is I think it's a good point about, these are all these big questions. If we, if we knew the definitive answer, then we could all just pack up and go home. But it's culture. Well, I suppose my view is that again, there is a narrow, very niche, hyper individualized idea of what culture is. And our industry, and I mean this very broadly in marketing in the broadest sense, I'm including advertising people in here, media people, researchers, planners, the whole lot. I'm using it in that broad sense. And certainly all the work that me and Andrew have done over the last 7 or 8 years, that's the way that when we talk about the industry, we've put everybody in there. And when we talk about the worldviews of the industry, that's what we're talking about in any particular, as opposed to any particular discipline. So our argument there would be that almost everything that our industry turns its attention to, it views it through this actually quite frankly elitist, hyper individualized, quite narrow worldview. One of the ways we talk about it is that it views everything as quite a straight line and dichotomous. Zero-sum thinking, categorization, it has to be this or that. And a lot of this comes from the disciplines that we're in. We're thinking about how you target people. If you're a researcher, you're thinking about segments and all these types of things. So a lot of it goes with the discipline, but it becomes this broader kind of, as I say, cultural worldview. And then when you get to big concepts like culture, you tend to again be insisting on atomizing the world and thinking about niches, etc. Well, to me, the other view of culture is that culture is actually a very kind of collective thing, that actually it's not driven necessarily by niches. People aren't actually looking always to stand out and define themselves as being different from others. They are, but it's not necessarily the dominant thing they're doing. A lot about what the mainstream are doing is they want to belong, they want to be the same as other people. So I think the thing about fandoms is really interesting. Fandoms in the narrative that the industry is talking about these days all seems to be about finding stuff that's at the bleeding edge of culture and finding niche fandoms where people can find a community. And it's not to say that isn't going on, but the biggest fandoms are actually things that bring diverse groups of people together in a very kind of common pursuit. I mean, again, let's use this. The Super Bowl is an analogy. Back here in the UK last week, there was a lot of big football on, the rugby. It's a big thing for me. These are things where mass events where no matter what else you've got going on and how diverse you are in other ways, you're all brought together by a kind of a common thing that unites. And I think the industry's impulse, based on all the work that me and Andrew have done, is always to go for the individualistic, the niche, the cutting edge, what we describe as neomania, the obsession with the new. And actually, most of what's going on out there in the real world most of the time is fitting in, doing stuff that's familiar, et cetera, et cetera. We did a couple of really interesting little experiments in one of the white papers where we asked people a series of questions based on some kind of academic research. But you ask people, if you buy a new car and then the next day your friend turns out they've bought the same car as you, how would you feel? Right? Now,
That's a great question.
the argument would be in marketing is, oh, that's terrible. I want to be an individual. I want to have done something that signals my identity and my unique kind of character. It turns out 90% of the mainstream say I would feel good because they like my car, right? If you
Yeah.
do it with trainers or,
Validation.
trainers or sneakers, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
These things that our whole industry is predicated on, sure, there's a kind of tapping into a fandom around streetwear or whatever you might be doing, but there's this deep, deep belief in individualism and signaling individual identity. When it turns out, actually, a lot of the people, as I say, out there in the real world, have got the dial turned completely the opposite way, and they're actually validated by fitting in and doing normal, basically, So that's the kind of disconnect that I think drives almost everything that you. The default setting for our industry is dialed much higher on individualism than it is for the audiences that we're trying to engage. We talked about in one of the white papers about how we need to balance the EQ, balance the graphic equalizer. We've got, to use the Spinal Tap, thing. We've got certain things like individualism dialed up to 11, and they
Yeah.
just, it's not that normal people don't have individualistic traits, but they've got them down maybe about five or something, and I've got other things in there as well. And we kind of go headlong into one part of what culture is.
I think that's really interesting. It takes me to a point that may be a result of that, which is what I'm sort of how I'm summarizing what you're a little bit what you're saying is sort of the reductive. We basically got this problem where we've got everything down to reductiveness, but it doesn't somehow connect. And when you look at the big, it's the simpler, bigger ideas that actually are do connect. And we sort of confuse, we're somewhere caught between the two things. And I think that leads to this sort of erosion of trust and things just looking out of kilter. And so on one, I always thought it was fascinating years ago. It's back to this, what is going to get somebody excited creatively? This whole idea of, well, we make work to get people excited about a brand. And we were invited into this YouTube thing, and it was sort of some kind of, it was a kind of workshop. And they said, well, would you want to see the best, the most viewed piece of content that we have? So they said, yeah, sure, that sounds interesting. And it was literally two girls who were just, explaining their shopping trip. It had, 33 million views or whatever it was. And it wasn't, it was in under no person's definition of creativity was it, could it be considered creative? But it was compelling. And I think that's a huge challenge too, that you have suddenly we've got these brands that seem to be not really, and they're not really having the right conversation or talking in the right way. And then you've got this one-on-one phenomenon with these content creators who somehow seem to be speaking, they don't have a brand, they're not talking through a brand lens, they're talking through a personal experiential lens. And that seems to be so much richer. And I think the longer that goes on, the sort of more difficult it becomes for brands because they just sort of look clueless.
Yeah, I mean, I think since it's a slightly tangential what you're saying there, but when you were talking, I was thinking about back to this thing about the two girls just talking about their shopping trip. One of the things there is if that in that naturalistic way, I think it's likely in situations like that, people talk about the stuff that interests them and the things that matter to them. And I think that's the thing when we're doing advertising now, a lot of the time we're thinking about, as I say, this idea of creativity or culture or any of the big words that we like to talk about go through this, as I say, narrow worldview. You know, so things have to be, creative has to be new, for example. Now, one of the things that's really interesting is the two girls talking about the shopping trip, they're not interested about new or anything. It's just about what they're interested in. But as soon as we put that layer on it about creativity or culture or any of these other big words, we get into this narrow worldview that takes us away from what matters to others. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that like Orlando Wood, for example, and the guys at System One, done a lot of work on this. I mean, Orlando Lemon, I think, absolutely fantastic. He was kind enough to reference our work in it, you know. Yep. That was great. But the, you know, System One on a weekly basis now, certainly over the Christmas period, I think I saw this, because obviously what happens at Christmas is everybody's trying to kind of do the big set piece, We Won Christmas, you know, with their advertising.
The Super Bowl, it's the UK equivalent of the Super Bowl.
It's the equivalent of the Super Bowl, yeah. And what happens is then some other big brands, they just wheel out the stuff they've been doing for years, like Coca-Cola, holidays are coming, the truck, and away it goes. And you know, what System One have been great at doing, and they've really dialed this up, I think, in the last couple of years, is they, you know, they measure every ad that comes out. And it turns out this idea about advertising creative wearing out is just a myth. You know, there might be other economic reasons why the advertising industry needs ads to wear out because they need to make new ads. But the idea that the effectiveness, you know, wears out over a certain amount of time. Because if someone likes something, they like to see it time and time again. But we are always in the industry thinking about wear out, something has to be new. What's the newest thing in culture? What's the newest thing we can tell people? And actually, once something is really kind of, you know, been embraced by people out there in the real world, they don't mind hearing it time and time again. Reinforcement and you know, things becoming, frankly, rituals, you know, are a good thing. But again, our industry worldview takes us away from these kind of realities. And I think that's one thing that's interesting about, and I don't know if with content, you know, it might be a happy accident, but if you just put two people talking about real stuff, you know, together, they aren't putting that kind of industry lens on it. It just is, you know, whatever it is they want to talk about, you know. So I suppose what I'm saying, to you know, in a nutshell, Ed, is I think we get in our own way quite a lot of the time. You know, it's like there's always those cliches, isn't there? There's the accusations that we're making ads for our colleagues and our pals in the industry rather than for the people out there. And there is something in that. We do seem to project a set of values onto a lot of these mass categories that actually don't necessarily hit home with the people that are buying the stuff.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot to talk about. I think the interesting thing for me maybe is that I guess you got the issue of distribution of GDP, right? So you've got this whole problem with London as being sort of the media center, and it controls a disproportionate amount of GDP, and it's sort of its island on its own, right? And then you've got where the rest of the country that isn't representative of London. So London, sort of London media values, London contemporaneous, London's place in the world, projected out in a country that doesn't necessarily work, you know? It's almost like you've got two countries in one.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. So this is where this in some ways brings us right up to date in terms of, you know, why is Andrew and I's latest venture called Burst Your Bubble, right? Mm-hmm. One of the things with the work we've been doing over the last 7 or 8 years in the white papers, one of the interpretations, and even from people that really embraced it and agreed with the arguments we were making, one of the interpretations would be, ah, that's it, it's the London bubble. That's the problem, you know, it's the London bubble, and culturally London's very different from the rest of the country, etc. Now, we very strongly argue that it's true that all the things you're talking about, GDP and investment, you know, there's a general election coming up in the UK, and a lot of it will be that debate about, you know, where does money go for infrastructure and all the other things. That's a real thing. But our argument would be the industry's letting itself off if it says, oh, it's the London bubble, we can't help it, we're all sitting in London, and we, you know, that's that kind of, if only we could get out there into the rest of the world and understand how real people live. We've written a couple of pieces about this, and quite hard-hitting in a way, and the argument is that, especially recently, is the ad world in London has moved eastwards, basically, you know, so what used to be in Soho and in the west of London, it's now moved to kind of east to places like Shoreditch and Hackney and, you know, that kind of stuff. And as it's done that, that's a process of gentrification, not that much different from, like, you know, Williamsburg in New York or something like that, right? Now, when you walk out side the front door of your agency in Hackney, and I lived in New York about 20 years ago, and Williamsburg wasn't quite where it is now, you know, but certainly the gentrification process was not where it is then. Or you walked out, if you're a pioneer and you were over there 20 years ago in Williamsburg, you walk out of there, the whole rich pageant of life is right outside the door of your agency, you know. Poverty, disenfranchisement, diversity, the whole thing is there. So we don't really buy this argument that it's a kind of metropolitan bubble. We would still say it's an industry bubble, because it's actually, you are literally stepping over the stuff, you know, that you're ignoring on your way to the agency in the morning, you know, or when you're waiting for your street food at lunchtime in the market.
You're choosing to, That's really interesting. Yeah. You don't have to go 500 miles to see it's right in front of your eyes.
That lands is I wrote a piece for Wark a couple of months ago, and it was called Burst Your Bubble About Empathy, right? And then I wrote a second one called Burst Your Bubble About Getting Out There. And the two things are linked, because there's this thing about we slap ourselves in the back about if we are either we are empathetic or we recognise that that's a key currency in the industry. That's how you get to the truth of things, you know, by being able to put yourself in other people's shoes. And then the next thing we say is, well, I need to get out of my London bubble and go and hang out in a pub in Newcastle, for example, to understand how real people. And what you're actually doing, and this, the efforts the industry is making supposedly to get real, just reinforce how far away it is from reality. Because, you know, the idea that London's this uniformly shiny kind of, you know, creative kind of, you know, like, you know, future facing place, and the rest of the UK's, you know, somewhere, that just reinforces, as I say, this.
Hasn't this been built? This thought has been built upon even further by this idea that it's actually about, not about geographies. It's actually about class in the industry.
Mm.
And it's to do with who works in the industry. And if you don't have working class people working in the industry, then you don't necessarily have the ingredients you need to understand it, because it's not first nature. And I saw somebody, I'm sure you've seen all this, there's been a lot of commentary in the last week or so about this.
There's
a big article in Creative Review.
Yeah, that's right. And that was riffing off, I think, I'm pretty sure that, where I go with this, Andrew and I've talked this for a long time as well. And for example, in our white papers, we focused very much in the Aspiration Window white paper on that kind of lack of social diversity, as we called it in the industry. But you know what's interesting, Ed, is as time has gone on, and that was a few years ago now, we published that white paper. Andrew and I started to feel uncomfortable at our own narrative there. Well, while it's true from a kind of, if you like, a social justice point of view, that we should have more social diverse and innocent, there should be opportunities for people to be socially mobile, and it shouldn't be so, frankly, elitist as it is in the industry. We landed on that argument that if you just, if you like, represented all the worldviews more adequately, then you'd end up with an industry that better understood. And then we started to feel uncomfortable about that because we thought, hang on, that sounds as if you're asking for the people who finally break down the barriers and get in, you know, to be responsible for transforming the industry, when actually it's supposed to be a craft skill that we all have anyway. We aren't actually doing our jobs properly if we can't transcend our own biases and actually engage with other worldviews and other perspectives. If we are saying we are so bound by, you know, our own backgrounds or our own little bubble that we can't do this, and it's like, oh, if only we could get out of London more or any of these things, we're basically just letting ourselves off the hook. Sure, we should have a more diverse industry in many, many ways, but wherever you're from, the basic job description should be about being able to transcend your biases, you know?
I think that's a great point. I think that sort of, to me, when you look back at the sort of history of account planning, there's two forces that shaped it. One is the brand, the Stephen King JWT model, which is the thing called brand. No one's known anything about it. I'm going to turn it into a science, and we're going to have people who really understand brands because brands have this tremendous value. And then there was this other situation that an agency got itself into that had just broken away from BMP, I think it was, or it was broken away from another agency. It was before BMP. And they had an account and they produced an ad and it worked or something. And then they made another one and it didn't work. And someone said, oh, we need to go and do some focus groups or something. And we knew, no, they didn't even know what a focus group was. I think they just said, let's go and talk to people. We can't. And then it was financially driven. If this thing had failed, they would have lost the only account they had. The choice they had to do was they had to go out and solicit opinion from people to make an ad that was reflective of what the input of people outside the office. That was the genesis of this idea. So what I think has happened is the craft of doing that has so diminished. There is no time. There is no budget. Qualitative research was a part of a planning cycle that every planner who worked on any agency, on any account, was going through. And qualitative research was part of it. There wasn't a question of not going out and talking to people. You went out and talked to people. It was part of what you did.
Yeah.
But then budgets got cut.
Yeah.
And then everyone sort of, sort of gave up. And so, there's such a change in that. So suddenly for someone to say, we're actually going out of the office again, seems revolutionary.
Yeah.
Because it's been so long since they've done anything like that.
Yeah. I think that's right. And I think that is it. So this is one of the things that, again, you know, we're kind of on this narrative on a day-to-day basis at Burst Your Bubble, because one of the things that we, exactly that, the kind of realities, we're working with some clients at the moment, and we hear these things from their teams all the time about, you know, no time, the cycle of how long they have to, you know, research something, come up with an idea, you know, get it back out again, is getting shorter and shorter. It's more and more time pressured. And so there is that thing, certainly with, I think, sometimes when we speak to younger people at the beginning of their careers, they sometimes think, you know, we're talking about some kind of golden days that will kind of never come back, you know, idea your time to go and talk to people and all that. So this is one of the things that Andrew and I thought about, and we think, well, right, look, we can't be just harking back and to this golden, age when there was more time. Well, what are the realities we've got now? We've got this incredible thing called the internet. We've got digital technology. We've got this incredible mass of kind of information that's out there. And Andrew and I became very interested with how is it that that isn't making an impact on this problem that we've identified, this gap we've identified between the worldview of the industry and the mainstream? Why isn't all the stuff we've got at our fingertips in terms of information and data and, all that's, why isn't that making a dent in this or any impact on it? And I think that's one of the things that comes to, again, it's we say we've got three kind of principles that we talk about, this thing called perspective taking, and that's really what we need to get better at, again, is being able to, we don't like empathy for certain reasons about it being emotionally driven, and there's actually quite a lot of scientific evidence now that focusing too much on empathy actually means you just end up having empathy for people like you because you're relying too much on emotion. So you need something that's a little bit more cognitive and deliberate about what are different perspectives. So then we have these three principles we talk about, and it's basically, one is knowledge. You need to kind of have more inputs coming in, that's just a basic thing. But the other fundamental one at the other end of the thing is having the motivation, So it's like, and this is where I think we keep falling down. And it's great if you can go out and speak to people. By all means, if you can get out there, you should get out there. There's no doubt about it. But if you don't have the time to do that, just having the will to kind of, as Rory Sutherland talked about last year at Nudgefest, embrace the mess, right? And the mess is all there at your fingertips, at your computer, on your laptop, at your desk, and just having the will to kind of, don't take the kind of path of least friction and like kind of challenge, what you might be thinking. And our argument is that if you have that kind of discipline to want things to be a bit messier and a bit more difficult and be challenged by different perspectives, you can do it even in the incredibly kind of constrained time that we all have now, because you can find it, it's out there, and we've got this incredible technology thing that brings the whole world to our desk. So I think, again, there's that. And there's another thing that's interesting about the narrative about getting out there. And that's this thing that a lot of the knowledge that we need to close this gap is, it already exists, it's there in social research data sets on, say I'm talking from a UK perspective again, the Office of National Statistics, you Google that, incredible amount of stuff is just there, loads of other kind of big sources of World Value Survey, various things, it's all there. And the idea that you have to get out there, it's almost like I struggle a little bit with the performative aspect of that we have to select some normal people that have to manifest these things for us directly before we believe they are real and we should do something about them, when actually a lot of it's already there and we just need to engage more with it.
My only pushback on that is there's something, is why I'm pushing for this photography for strategists thing. Which I'm doing, which is, there's something about the engagement and experience that makes you more powerful. And I think you can read all you want, you can sit behind your desk all you want, but if I'm looking at two pieces of work, and one planner has done all the social, but one's gone out to investigate further and actually talk to people, I'm going to pick the person who's been out there. It just gives me, I know it has a performative aspect to it, but I actually believe that there's something to be gained and gleaned in a way that you just can't get.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. But what I'm saying is that if you're in this incredibly
what you're saying is it's not,
the ideal, but in the absence of it, there's other stuff we can be
motivation,
doing.
Motivation. Yeah.
Whereas if you just say, this is the pure form, and I don't, and no one's giving me the time to do the pure form. Therefore, I'll just go back to projecting my worldviews onto the mainstream. There's got to be something in between, basically, and that's like, you know, embrace all the mess that's there, and be kind of, you know, what would you say, you know, basically challenge yourself, you know, but it's difficult. I think you know, marketers, advertisers, media people, researchers, we're all human beings too. And here's the thing, probably we're at least as motivated with fitting in to our community and signaling that, you know, we understand that, rather than, you know, understanding the thing that's out there, basically, you know, other people.
Yep. Yeah, so interesting. So what are you thinking of for 2024? What are the things that you, as you built on this, and we turn into election years and both sides of the pond and all those issues around that, and we've got AI emerging as such kind of this sort of new shiny thing in marketing. Where do you see 2024 in terms of your mindset and worldview?
Well, funnily enough, I'm sitting down at my desk tomorrow to write a thing which is all about, in an election year, you know, as we're hearing, because all the ways that it's working, there's elections all over the place. It's one of the biggest election years globally ever. I can't remember the stat about how many people are going to the polls, but it's a huge year, obviously US, UK, etc. And given all the stuff that we're very familiar with now, the narratives in our industry about the need for change, the social ecological crisis that we're in, you know, perma crisis, all these things that get talked about quite a lot in our industry, and the one thing that we've been quite critical in the past of so-called brand purpose, but there's no doubt from all the work that we do that lots of people in our industry genuinely want to try and make a difference and contribute. And here we've got an election year coming up, and young people feel a lot of these forces more than anybody else, because they're going to have longer to live through it all, whatever the mess is. But I'm about to write a piece which is, again, about how, you know, we're kind of letting young people down with the kind of narrative that we're giving them. You know, in an election year, the World Values Survey, the latest edition of the World Values Survey, has a shocking statistic in it, which is that 49%, only 49% of 16 to 24-year-olds think that free elections are an essential part of democracy. Yeah. Now, I think everybody that will be listening to this would agree that's a shocking statistic. What I want our industry to think about more is our role and where we got there, how we got to that. And there is this thing that if you're saying that you can change the world through hyper-individualized consumption, you know, just buying the right products or brands, the argument is, and there's a lot of work being done on this now, that basically what is happening is our narrative about socially conscious consumption is pushing young people in particular away from the thing that actually still does affect change, which is voting the right people into kind of, you know, power. And so I think
these people, it's brands that make a difference, and I don't need to worry about
it. Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot of academic stuff now, but this idea about young people in particular being pushed away from electoral politics and pulled into more and more to the market as the solution to everything. And I think it's going to be interesting this year. Don't know how the elections will pan out, but one thing I can guarantee you will be part of the analysis. In a previous life, I was a political researcher. That's where I started, in academia. And one thing that will definitely be part of the narrative is how many young people got out to vote, and if more young people are out to vote rather than old people voting, what would it have looked like? Would it have been different, right? And I think the thing is that our industry will throw its hands up if we don't get the results that we think we should in terms of that fits our progressive agenda. But ironically, we might have to look more closely at ourselves and see how we might be influencing how young people think about change happening in the world, and how we might be actually, you know, letting them down, frankly, about not, you know, encouraging them to be more active. And
I wonder if that's, I wonder if it's less about, I mean, it seems like advertising a factor, but it's more like, isn't it the sort of, isn't it this whole entrepreneurial spirit that's the capitalist, you can build something that can change the world? Isn't that more of a force than some brand message? You know, the idea that you want to be, I want to be the next Zuckerberg, you know?
Yeah, except I think, Ed, what I'm actually arguing, and I know I've not got a lot of time left to kind of, you know, talk about this, is that I think we are part of that deeper, what would you say, you know, paradigm, which is, yeah, very frankly neoliberal paradigm, where it's all about, you know, the market and business, rather than, but we want to be part of social change, and the mechanisms of doing that, again, maybe need to be broader than where we can't push everybody down this kind of, yeah, you know, changing the world, business does it better than governments, etc., which has been this, you know, the narrative for a long, long time. And I think, again, there's this disconnect between what seems to be a radical narrative in our industry and actually bolting it on to, frankly, what has been the orthodoxy since the Second World War, which is like free market neoliberal capitalism. So, you know, just a little thing like that that I'm thinking about in 2024.
So just I know so we're up against time. What things have you seen that have been encouraging? I know we're very disparaging of the initiatives the industry has taken. Have you seen anything, or from the marketing world, that has actually encouraged you to say, actually, people are starting to understand it, or is this seems like a something that others could follow?
I mean, I think my argument, as I've spent more and more time talking about this stuff, I've realised that, you know, it's actually quite a subtle argument that I'm trying to make, because I have no... See, one of the things that happened, a lot of the stuff that I've written over the last few years, frankly, it can be misinterpreted. And, you know, there's a reactionary take on it, which is absolutely not what we're saying. We're not saying young people shouldn't be concerned about the stuff that's going on. They shouldn't be want to make their industries and their businesses better and all that kind of stuff. My thing is to... So I think the fact that we're talking so much about diversity in the industry, you know, representation, fairness, all those things, and there are inroads being made, it's a slow process, but I think that's all positive stuff, and it's very, it should have been happening a long time, and now it is happening. And I do feel as if they are things that aren't, as some people argue, you know, another trend that will kind of melt away. I don't think that's going, I think it's embedded now, and I think it's going to, and I think that's great. My argument is always that think a little bit more critically about the mechanisms and the levers that you can use, and if the ones that you're using right now are the most effective ones to do it. And so I think, generally speaking, the narrative is the right one. I think it's very positive that, you know, businesses are thinking more about having a more representative workforce and representing people more accurately in advertising. That's all there. But it's about thinking about the bigger forces that our industry is part of, and whether we are going with the flow, or are we really being as radical as we could be, you know? And I think, so that's where all of my stuff is about. So I think that the conversations are the right ones, and now I think it's just about getting a little bit deeper and more critical about what's the next phase of that. It's on the agenda now. How do we actually turn the dial up on them? And so when I get critical about it, and I seem to be criticising a lot, it's with the idea of hopefully making the next step to really kind of land some of this stuff and affect bigger change with it. And so I think that we're on the right, and the momentum's building. It's just about, you know, how we kind of stop and kind of take stock a little bit, and, you know, make some adjustments and, you know, move again.
Cool. Well, Ian, thanks very much for your time. I really enjoyed talking to you. This great conversation, really a lot of fascinating ideas. So I do appreciate it.
I loved it as well. Thanks for having me, Ed.